This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
And I'm Michael Pollitt.
Writing is a stepping back and a listening more than a putting energy out and directing. When we're able to be open and listen, that feeds into the authenticity piece.
That's Lorraine Herring. She's our first guest today, and she'll be talking about her book, Writing Begins with the Breath. And in the second half of the show, Junot Diaz will be joining us live here on the program to talk about his acclaimed new novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. But first, Lorraine Herring. Her book, Writing Begins with the Breath, Embodying Your Authentic Voice, is a guide to the craft of writing. Using yoga and Buddhist psychology, she shows us how to tune into our bodies and connect with our emotions so that our writing becomes an expression of our full being rather than just an intellectual exercise. Herring is an author and teacher, playwright and editor with a background in counseling. She lives in Prescott, Arizona. Her works include Monsoons, a book of prose and poetry published in 1999, Lost Father, How Women Can Heal from Adolescent Father Loss, came out in 2005. She's written two novels, Lay My Sorrows Down in 2000 and Bone Dance in 2006. Herring runs writing workshops, often community-based, with an emphasis on the healing potential of writing. Lorraine Herring, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Now, your book, Writing Begins with a Breath, Embodying Your Authentic Voice, this is very much seems grounded in the disciplines of Zen Buddhism and yoga.
I would agree with that, yeah. I came to practicing yoga about 9 or 10 years ago, just at a gym down in Phoenix, and it wasn't, a very deep practice at all. It was just, a couple poses and things, but I started to notice mostly how distant and detached I had gotten from my body. And the more I began to pay attention to that, the more I began to look at, well, Lorraine, your writing's not quite doing what you thought. Other things aren't doing quite what you thought. There's some piece that's not working very well. And so I moved into more of a deeper practice. And then I met a man who was very active in Zen Buddhism, and I went and sat with him, did a lot of work trying to just learn how to be still. And I certainly wouldn't say I've mastered the stillness part, but I'm very much aware of how important it is to just stay in the chair. And so really from that, I think the book did evolve from that place.
And also from another place, you say that you studied writing as a healing tool from grief and loss.
Yeah.
Talk about how did that influence this book?
I first got an MFA in creative writing, and then I really began teaching creative writing actively and went back to get a second master's because I realized that I really needed to understand more about my students' psychological makeup in order to really help them with their stories. And through that process, the book prior to this book was born. It's called Lost Fathers, and that came about from my own loss. My dad died when I was 19, and writing was the one thing that I just, I've done my whole life, and it was always a sanctuary and a place to go to that was safe. And when I began looking at it, how to bring that out into the world a little bit, I saw there was actually quite a field of study around using writing as a healing tool, and that was a very life-changing moment. Once I got a hold of, wow, I not just teach people how to write stories, but I can help people, just open up their own hearts, regardless of whether they care about publication or not. So I started doing some groups. I worked with several halfway houses down in the Phoenix area. I worked for substance abuse centers. I worked with veterans. I did a whole lot of work with juvenile prisons, just practicing all this and seeing, wow, what can poetry do? What can writing do? And I really saw that writing is just truly a holistic activity. It's not a series of steps. It's not a one-size-fits-all formula, and it's really available to every single human being. It's not about talent or no talent. It's about getting to understand yourself better.
Could you say more about what you mean by holistic?
I think one of the initial tendencies of people coming to, especially creative writing classes, is that they have an idea for a story, and that idea is in their brain and in their head, and All they have to do is find a way to make their head make sense on paper. But because the body stores stories, our body stores emotions, our body is the vehicle for how we've navigated our entire lives, when we short-circuit that piece of it, the work comes across as very dry. It might be technically perfect, but it's missing a heartbeat in a way, because it doesn't, the writer hasn't allowed themselves to move more deeply into their body.
You know, I heard somewhere, and I don't remember who the writer was, it was some famous writer, who said that when they get stuck, they take a walk, mm-hmm. and that unstucks them.
Yeah, any kind of movement, and you know, I certainly don't think I'm the one that pioneered this idea at all, but my nature is not to move a lot. I'm very comfortable sitting down and reading and writing. And
you can be still.
I can be still, and I mean, from birth, my mother tells stories of, well, she just sat on the floor till she was three, and then she walked. You know, she didn't do anything else, just watching. And so I've never been, you know, too uncomfortable with just sitting, but the body is. You know, the body needs to stretch. The body needs to move, and fingers need to expand and contract, and your neck needs to uncrick, because that frees up the energy channels in the body. It opens up the meridians. It opens up, you know, just a chance for your chi or your energy to move again. And I hadn't known that it gets stuck until I began studying yoga. I didn't know anything about that part of the body.
And you've actually incorporated physical exercises into your book.
Yeah, because if people would just stand up, what does it feel like to stand? What does it feel like to sit in child's pose, which is more of a resting pose? What does it feel like just to look at your body? One of the exercises is you just open your hands, you press your hands together, and you just open them like a book and close them and open them and close them, and just moving in, paying more, you know, more attention to where you live. It helps you see better as a writer, you know, helps you focus a little bit. Gives you some compassion. You know, you stare at your finger for an awfully long time, you're going to fall in love with your finger. You know, I mean, you just look at it, it's an amazing thing, a finger, you know, and all the things it does for you, and all the, you know, how much attention do you pay in a normal day to your finger unless it hurts.
I actually tried a few of the exercises. You've separated your chapters into various really spiritual concepts: risk, authenticity, curiosity, empathy, process versus product. We'll go through some of these, but on the one of risk, you suggest an exercise of just tipping your head back and letting your throat be bare.
Mm-hmm.
Why that?
When you're tilting back, and I'm actually doing it right now, you know, your jugular is exposed. If someone was going to come and, I mean, back very primally, someone could kill you when you open up your throat like that. On a more spiritual level, this is opening up the heart chakra, it's opening up the throat chakra. So the energy that is often stuck in those two places has a chance to begin to flow and move. We think about, you know, a closed position to protect ourselves. You know, shoulders are hunched or arms are put in front, or, you know, your head is down. To put your shoulders back, to put your head back, to open up that way is really presenting who you are to the world in a way that a lot of people have shut away from because the world is full of scary things.
Lorraine, may I jump in here?
Sure.
Doing exercises, being physical, paying attention to your body is really a way of being present. Does that have anything to do with being able to write or the source of writing?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, students and certainly myself too, coming with just an idea, being up in the head, that tends to put you in a place of either thinking about what you want to be writing or thinking back on what you have written rather than actually writing. And writers have a zone just like athletes or, you know, anything else too. When we get in it, you know, time falls away. And the more we can get into that on a regular basis, the more productive and the more authentic our writing is going to be. And so one of the things that yoga does, or really any kind of movement, is it you can't be thinking about much else or you'll fall over or you'll run into a telephone pole if you're jogging down the street, or, you know, you have to be really in your body or a whole bunch of discomfort can happen. So getting comfortable in that and recognizing what it feels like when you're there, when your mind isn't 1,000 miles away. You know, everyone's mind is jumping around all the time. You know, when we start to notice what it is doing. Something else about that, too, is that yoga postures in particular are designed to put you in places of discomfort, even if you're just, you know, standing with one foot, you know, a little bit up on your ankle even maybe, because you, we tend to want change so much. You know, the mind is like, oh my God, I got to move. And all it's looking for is that next thing that's different. And that happens when we sit down in the chair to write too. We start and it's good, and then, ooh, maybe I could write about that. Or the phone rings, or the email goes off, or, you know, there's so many distractions that chase us out of that moment into the next. And so another piece of it is to practice being with the discomfort and the distractions that arise and staying present, not surrendering to the next, you know, the next thing that comes around.
And I want to tell our listeners, we're talking with Lorraine Herring about her book, Writing Begins with the Breath, Embodying Your Authentic Voice. And there's another point there that you make, that it involves trust, not just taking a risk. And I have to say, I think writing takes a tremendous amount of courage.
Yeah.
To really do. And you talk about authenticity and trust. How does this come in here?
I think there's two elements to the trust piece. I think we have to first trust that this is something that, that is valuable and worthwhile for us to do, regardless of a publication outcome or, you know, anything like that. We have to believe enough in ourselves to do it. And then the second piece, which is often a little bit harder, I think, is to trust the work. In one of my graduate programs, one of the themes was trust the process. And this is even that the first session of administrative stuff, you know, where they give you all the forms and all the things you've got to do for the next 2 years. And then they wouldn't answer any questions. They would walk around and say, oh, just trust the process, it'll work out. And this so unnerved, you know, a lot of people, because it's like, hey, I want to know, what's the next step? What's, you know, what's ABC? And by the end of the 2 years, it was like, oh, yeah, you know, the process worked. I got here. But it takes some beating almost to get out of that need to maybe outline, to control, to direct the work. Writing is a stepping back and a listening more than a, you know, than a putting energy out and directing. When we're able to be open and listen, that feeds into the authenticity piece. Because I'm going to decide what I want to tell you. I'm going to sculpt it in a way that's going to present me in the best possible light, going to hide all my flaws and icky stuff, going to, you know, going to make it as pretty as possible. But if I step back and let what's in me speak, then I'm going to surprise even myself with what might be in there and what might be real. And it's through the authenticity piece, through being absolutely vulnerable and real with our work, that we make connections to other people. I believe readers connect to books from the heart rather than from the head. You know, I mean, you might read a book, an informational book, you know, to just figure out how to install your sink or something, and that's one kind of writing. But you read a novel and you get pulled into a world and pulled into these characters' lives, it's because your heart opened up to them, not because your mind has analyzed that, oh, well, these are interesting people and I would like to, you know, there's some piece of feeling in that. And if the writer isn't open and feeling, then that isn't able to be achieved between the reader and the writer.
In fact, you say that in terms of developing a voice or one's own voice, writers struggle with their voice because they struggle with the process of listening. What is so hard about listening for a writer?
Well, I think first it's kind of what's so hard about listening for anybody. Often we're in a situation and we're waiting for the next person to finish talking so we can respond to what they say, rather than just listening and hearing without trying to formulate an immediate response to that. You know, that's one step where we're out of the present moment, even in our listening. I think of an argument, you know, I'm waiting for the point to get in and prove my point, you know, or oh, here's where she's wrong, here's where he's wrong. And if you learn to step back and listen to what someone is saying and not be so ready to jump in with a response, then I can hear better and I'm more present. And so I think that same thing translates over when writers sit down to try to listen to their work. It takes patience. It takes time. It often feels like just sitting and waiting is not writing, but it is. You know, it doesn't feel like I need to be always putting words down one after the other. And that space that it takes to back away and really hear what's inside is a place of absolute vulnerability as well. It's easier, I think, if I decide to tell myself what I'm going to think. Here's what I'm going to say, here's what my characters are going to do, here's the next step that's going to happen, because that eliminates the risk.
You know, we have a lot of literature these days which is almost excessively self-revelatory.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it feels to me that that's not necessarily authentic. What's your take on that? What's your take on kind of the penchant for some writers just to splay their story right out all over, you know, without really having kind of a sense of objectivity or being able to step back?
Or is that really being vulnerable?
I don't think it is. I don't think just dumping my stuff on another human being is vulnerable. It's also kind of rude, you know? I mean, I think, I don't know why there's such a proliferation of that. In class, we were talking about it yesterday, actually. You know, I think the reality TV shows and some of the other media that people seem to be gravitating to kind of fuel this, I'm exposed in real, but not really. Is MTV's Real World real? So I don't find that kind of complete evisceration to really be authentic writing. You need that detachment piece because you want to tell a story that others can find themselves in as well, not just you.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Goodkind, who's and it might be Goodkind, I'm never sure how to pronounce his name, he runs the journal Creative Nonfiction.
Yes.
He talks about the egocentrism of creative nonfiction writers and how that's one of the number one reason why, you know, their essays get rejected or the books don't really go any further, because they're not able to see a larger story in their own story yet. They only see their story. And sometimes the story, I think, isn't ready, and maybe sometimes it's just such a dramatic story that a publisher says, oh, wow, we got to talk about that right now because it's such a great, you know, memoir or something, and the writer hasn't done the work necessary to put it in a place where it can then be, you know, kind of analyzed. When you're writing memoir, you become a character, and you have to be able to put that level of detachment between you and you, which is a whole other thing. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, that does make sense. I have struggled with the opposite problem. In writing a memoir, I have been so interested in my observations that people who have read it have said, well, but what's going on with you? Where do you find that balance between yourself? Am I really trying to avoid talking about myself, or is it just that I'm really trying to share the story of what I've seen with others?
I'm thinking about something that's actually a trait of fiction, and it's called a first-person peripheral narrator. You know, we talk about that there's a regular first-person, you know, the I voice, and that's the main protagonist in the story, and that's the character that's going through the primary arc and the primary change. But another way to use first-person is as a peripheral narrator, and so that means that the first-person voice, the I voice, is standing off to the side, essentially telling the story of somebody else or of other people. And the key to the success of that is that somehow that first-person voice has to be changed by the telling of the story. It can't just be, you know, like a Greek theater offstage, you know, and behold, here are these, you know, these people, and then come back at the end and kind of sum it all up. There has to be some thread that connects the voice to the other people, but that's a way that people have told memoirs about their fathers or about their, you know, other people's stories, not necessarily their own. By the end of the book, the reader understands that through the telling of the story, the narrator has also been changed or grown or, you know, learned something as well.
It's interesting that a professor that I studied with psychology talked about mask a lot, and the Greek mask. And mask, you usually think of hiding the person, but he said, no, the mask actually reveals the person in a way that you won't get by looking directly in the person's face. So the mask you choose already reveals who you are. So there's something there in choosing your words or your subject matter or what you observe.
Right.
That reveals who you are.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you were saying earlier, the kind of, you want to tell the kind of what you observed in these other people, you're picking things that matter to you for some reason. Mm. And that's maybe the heart of the secondary narrative.
Right. And telling a larger point. I think that's that is a very nice way of putting it, because I think the other aspect that you speak about in your book, Writing Begins with a Breath, is self-awareness, which is, I think, something I guess we've been talking about all along here. sometimes it can be crippling. Sometimes it can take too much of a role.
Exactly.
But isn't that kind of what you're saying here, that even when you're narrating, you know, you're being kind of Ishmael, you know, call me Ishmael, mm-hmm. you're telling the story of Moby Dick and Captain Ahab, you're still a part of that story.
Right, because I'm going to pick the events that somehow matter to me. You know, I'm going to tell, say my sister and I are at a dinner, and I'm going to retell the story to a friend based off of what struck me, and she would tell the events based on what struck her, and they were not going to be exactly the same, you know, because we're each different people coming to the same situation with things we're already either looking for or open to or not really wanting to go there with, kind of what, you know, what I think we pick when we choose a narrator for a piece, whether it is a memoir or a, you know, or a novel. That's the vantage point through which we view the work. So that's the filter. There's always a filter. There's not always a filter. And there needs to be a filter so that there's a focus.
And that filter is then born out of?
Well, the filter is born out of point of view choice, but the filter is born out of what are the passions of the author, what are the things that might make the author you know, confused, angry, sad, whatever's brewing up inside are the questions that kind of keep sticking in the back of a writer's mind. And writing is a way of exploring those questions. And I think the things, the scenes, the situations, the events we come into contact with that feed some deeper understanding of our questions are what gets selected as the framework of that lens.
And in fact, in that light, your chapter on empathy, you had an experience that you recount I found quite interesting. You said when you were writing your novel Bone Dance, that you struggled to find the right point of view, and a friend told you to write it from a first-person male point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, that seemed repugnant to you.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it repugnant, and how did you overcome that?
It was repugnant for absolutely personal reason. I still had issues around my dad's death and around trusting that men could be present and open and actually were, and this is going to sound horrible, but humans. and it stuns me to look back and think, wow, I really thought that, but I didn't consciously think it, but it was a part of how I was shaping all my work and really kind of shaping my relationships too. It was just this, well, they're the other, and you know, women are like this and men are like this, and it was a very dualistic place, and I couldn't bridge that because I had the wall up, not because men had the wall up. So it was looking at, wow, why did I build that wall? What can I do to take the wall down? Because I really do believe, you know, they're human beings, and so how to find a way to speak through that sensibility. And it was an absolutely amazing exercise for me to do and get a chance to see, look at all what's still inside of me around this. And it's made, of course, it's opened my writing quite a bit because, boy, it's hard to not ever write from the point of view of a man.
Even to the extent of writing about sex as a man.
Yeah, well, that was her exercise, like to write about a man making love to a woman. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, what would that even be like? And so the first piece wasn't that I couldn't imagine a man, you know, making love to a woman. I couldn't imagine the love part.
Mm.
And that's just that was just my personal thing. And, you know, this might be no issue at all for, you know, for a different writer. They might have another, you know, block around something. But that was a huge, let's step into that skin. And what does it feel like to be tender? To be, you know, things that just due to things that had happened to me made me think that was not possible.
Writing Begins with a Breath is the name of the book, and we're talking with the author, Lorraine Herring. You also talk about developing a relationship, talking about relationships, developing a relationship to your writing.
Mm-hmm.
You say that one should personify it, make it a character in your life. What do you mean by that?
Just, you know, just being a writer, I think it's always cool to make everything a character. You know, I name the coffee pot and the TV and the, you know, I mean, everything is kind of got some life in there somehow. But for writing to really be something that you are rather than something that you do, it has to live in your life in a different way. If I have to take a writing class all the time in order to ever do any writing, it's still separate. If a teacher has to impose deadlines on me to do anything, it's still, you know, a little bit separate. And so by making it a character, I first began thinking of it like a lover. You know, what kind of time do I need to give to a partner in order for that relationship to work? You know, like I mentioned in the book, if I don't ever talk to that person for 6 months, it's going to be really hard to have dinner and pick it up, you know, right where you left off. And writing needs that kind of nurturance, that kind of, you know, hi, I'm still here, I'm paying attention to you. Right now I have to go to work, but I'm listening, I hear this, and, you know, there'll be time tomorrow morning at this time, or, you know, putting it in a way where you honor it, and then it honors you back, rather than almost like putting it in the closet until all the conditions are perfect.
As we mentioned, Buddhism is one of the traditions that informs the writing of this book. Writing begins with a breath. Buddhism is primarily about the issue of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the traps of suffering that writers fall into?
One of them is worrying about an outcome and putting everything out into the future. Am I going to get an agent? Am I going to get published? Am I going to get this? What is somebody going to see or view about my work? That's certainly one way. Another way they fall into a trap of suffering is wanting the work to be something different than what it actually is. I might have an idea for a novel, and I love my idea, and then I start writing, and the work turns out to be talking about something else. I have to be willing to surrender what I had thought it was going to be, or I'm going to be fighting it, which mm-hmm. is going to create that suffering. That's a way of trying to control the work in the beginning that can cause a lot of stress.
And also, the proverbial greatest pain of writing would be writer's block. And you kind of turn it around. You frame it in a different way. You frame writer's block as not something that the writing is not blocking the writer, but that the writer is blocking the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the use of that?
The use of that is it gives you, first of all, it gives you empowerment to do something about it. If I think the writing is blocked, then that's outside of me, and then I'm waiting for the writing to become unblocked, I don't know, by a bolt of lightning or, you know, something out there to change the situation. If I look at it, well, wow, I'm not accessing something, or I'm not able to be open to this right now, then I can look at ways to shift that. And also, you know, just to put the tool back in the hand of the author. This is what, you know, Natalie Goldberg did so well with just keep the pen moving, you know, just, you know, write, I have nothing to say, I don't know what's going on, I want an apple, I wish the cat would stop clawing my couch, you know, whatever's happening, to just move beyond that piece. And writer's block, I think, with many people, it grows, you know, the more you feed it energy. Like, I have this block, and then I talk about the block, and then I talk about how long I've had the block, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I would much rather see writers take a look at how they can adjust their space to allow the writing in rather than look for some outside force to change a situation for them.
And finally, one of your last chapters, not the last, but one of them, is about impermanence. What's a lesson here for a writer?
You got to let it go. Writing changes, you change. The way your work is perceived today is going to be perceived differently in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. There's just not anything that you can put a box around and keep the same. To me, one of the neat things about writing is that it is this relationship between or among three things: the writer, the work, and the reader. And without all three of them, the work doesn't live, or live fully, I should say. When the reader picks up a book, they bring their piece of magic to the words. And the words are neutral. The book is printed, the words are neutral. I put my piece into it, and then the reader picks up and puts his or her piece into it, and then you get that connection. You get that, oh, this touched me, this moved me, or, you know, or it didn't. But that's the variable. That's the X factor of writing, and we have to be willing to recognize that our work is going to be perceived differently by every single reader, and have that be okay.
Well, the book is Writing Begins with a Breath, Embodying Your Authentic Voice. Lorraine Herring, this has been a wonderful conversation about the process of writing. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Thank you.
Lorraine Herring is currently working on a third novel, Unbearable Compassion. Next up, we'll talk with Juno Diaz about his truly wondrous new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. That's right after the break. And that's Eres Mentirosa by the Dominican band Caña Brava on The Rough Guide to Merengue. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
And I'm Michael Pollitt.
Today we have the special honor of speaking with author Juno Diaz from his hotel in Washington, D.C., where he's on book tour for his just-published novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, a literary sensation sweeping the book charts. It's about an overweight, socially challenged young literary genius and sci-fi nerd from the Dominican community of Paterson, New Jersey. But it's also about much, much more. The book moves between New Jersey and the Dominican Republic and back and forth in time, ranging over the history, magic, and passion, in both senses of the word, of that haunted Caribbean nation and its people. Diaz's work expresses the blood and guts, the trials, the successes, and unmet dreams, the homesickness, and inside-outside intensity of the immigrant experience. The first Dominican-born man to become a major author in the United States, The New Yorker listed Juno Diaz as one of the 20 top writers of the 21st century. He's been published also in Story, The Paris Review, and in the anthologies Best American Short Stories and African Voices. In addition to The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, just out from Riverhead Books, he wrote the critically acclaimed short story collection Drown, published in 1996. He currently teaches creative writing at MIT and is fiction editor for Boston Review. Juno Diaz, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much. That was quite an introduction.
That's great. Welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you've described yourself as, quote, one of those people who not only want to tell a story, but also want to break the rules. You were referring to writing about politics without letting the reader think that it's political. You know, I was struck how in your book, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, how it begins right smack dab in the political, writing about the Dominican Republic's longtime dictator, Trujillo, almost as if he's a kind of brujo, a sorcerer, the Sauron of the Dominican Republic. And you've got footnotes, too. It's the first time I've ever seen footnotes in a novel. Is this mixture of magic, politics, and erudition an example of breaking the rules as you talked about them?
I don't think so much that. I think in some ways that's just a lot of literary forms that I've like kind of borrowed, kind of cribbed, kind of stolen. You know, for me, more when I think of breaking the rules, it's more the kind of the narrative's sort of non-linear structure. But you know, one person's rules breaking is not anyone else's. So probably when I think I'm being mischievous, most people think I'm just being a fool. You know. And the times that I'm being, like, the dullest, there's probably some people who are like, see, that's when he's really being transgressive.
Can you give an example?
Well, I mean, I think that I'm always obsessed with, can I simultaneously talk about something and have the thing that I'm talking about actually be absent? So, for example, the protagonist of our novel, Oscar de Leon, he's actually talked about constantly throughout the book, but what one realizes by the end of it is that you actually never meet Oscar.
Right. Say more about that. What do you mean by you never meet him?
He's actually, you never meet him. He's a mediated presence.
Right.
It's only in the last few lines you actually read anything that the guy ever wrote directly.
Yes.
And, you know, he's this presence in the book, but what the narrative is hiding is that he's actually not present at all. He's someone else's. He's caught in someone else's narrative.
Well, yes. And, you know, you write from many different voices in this book, or at least several of them, in his family. And that was a question I had. But I'm wondering if maybe we should clue our readers in, our listeners in first. Tell us a little bit about the story, and why do you start in the Dominican Republic there?
Oh, I mean, it's part of this weird little book about a family, a Dominican family that lives in New Jersey, who some of the family members think they may be cursed, that the family is besieged by this very ancient Dominican curse. And so the book sort of tracks the family through the last 50 years, you know, focusing most centrally on the oldest son, the poor fat Oscar, who, you know, he just loves science fiction and Star Wars, and all he wants is a girlfriend, but he seems to be doomed never to find one. And so I kind of begin the book with a discussion of the early roots of where this curse comes from, where this fuku, its origins, in a way.
Right, and this is part of Dominican lore.
Yeah, no, it's something I grew up with, and I always, you know, I always heard the neighbors and the family and my own parents talking about it, and it just seemed like something so, like, wild. I'm like, damn, I would really love to have this in a story somewhere.
And it's very connected, though, to the history. I mean, Trujillo is like the dictator. He was dictator from 1931 to the 1960s. He seems like an agent of Fuku.
Yeah, in some ways people couldn't decide if he was, you know, the most horrible iteration of the curse or if he somehow had figured a way to manipulate it. You know, I mean, there's so many references in Dominican folkloric history about Trujillo's sort of supernatural powers and his ability to inflict curses on people. And some of them I had to even just cut out because the book couldn't contain them. I mean, in Santo Domingo lore, there's the idea that Trujillo, one of Trujillo's curses killed one of the popes. And that's like something that you'll always hear out in the countryside. People from that era will talk about it, and I was going to put it in the book, but I just didn't have any place to stick it in.
And he, now this curse and Trujillo, has a very intimate bearing on the history of this family. Say something about that and how they become part of the Dominican diaspora.
Well, in some ways, the family is, you know, you begin first meeting its most modern members. You meet the brother and sister team, Oscar and Lola, living in Paterson, New Jersey, and really trying to find their way through, you know, what we call the American experience. But, you know, the narrative begins to loop back, and you begin to see the family, that this is a family that are, they're survivors of a much earlier cataclysm where the roots of their family was exterminated by the Trujillo regime, by the dictatorship in the 40s. And these are the survivor descendants of this kind of purge, with which a lot of people believe was actually, you know, fomented, was actually a product of a curse. It's a way that people, you know, some people like to explain things in kind of a material way, some in a socialist way, and other people are like, hey, you have no male children because you're cursed.
Now, this is a curse in the Dominican Republic that is seen as something that pertains particularly to that country, or is it just seen as a kind of universal power in the world?
Well, the fuku is definitely of homegrown origin, but people think it's everywhere. So they think the curse is follows us wherever we go.
So the fuku that you grew up with was fuku in Paterson, New Jersey. Is that right? New Jersey fuku?
I kind of grew up with the shadow of it, in the sense that, you know, you heard about all these things and people would tell you. I honestly had a neighbor who couldn't have any sons, and everyone told him, oh, yeah, he got cursed back in Santo Domingo because he betrayed an old lover, you know? And I, like, used to love these stories. I used to just collect mm-hmm. them, you know? And there's a part of me that looked around, and you were thinking, my God, part of what these narratives were, you know, to my, like, kind of nerdy brain, was an attempt to, like, grapple with the unseen shadow of history in many people's lives.
The unseen shadow?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
That, for example, you know, this guy who I knew as a neighbor, I just saw him and I saw his daughters, and when someone talked about this, an element of his personal history became apparent, wasn't there before.
Right.
That he had a lover that he had hurt very deeply, and deeply enough so that someone would say that, yeah, you know, probably what he did to this person is the reason he can't have any sons.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, it seems so much that what you just called the unseen personal history is also parallel to and interwoven with the history of the country of your origin, of the Dominican Republic. So it's a kind of, it's a weaving back and forth of the particular and the personal with the general and the global, the macro level.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, one thing that Santo Domingo and the United States share in common, of course, besides just that they're both children of the New World, it's that there's, in both places and for very different reasons, there's enormous silences at the heart of the culture. Things that are not said, that people are taught not to look at, that people are taught that it's not polite to talk about. And as an artist, these, of course, are the most fertile acres, you know, where you're not supposed to go or where language has difficulty cohering. I mean, in the United States, we're not really supposed to talk about, we're supposed to talk about being this incredible gift of democracy, but we're not supposed to talk about the fact that, you know, in the last 100 years, we've started so many wars.
Mm-hmm. And one of them being in the Dominican Republic, or
certainly.
Two of them, actually.
Well, yeah, two occupations.
That's right.
And so, you know, there's always a silence, and I'm really interested in that as an artist, you know. And, of course, the Dominican Republic, one of the largest silences, is what, you know, the discovery of the New World was a cataclysmic, violent, apocalyptic event, but... You know, if you go to the Caribbean, it's all fun and beaches and sipping drinks out of coconuts.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Junot Diaz about his book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Now, of course, the other side of that experience then is the diaspora. So many people had to leave the Dominican Republic for not only political but also economic reasons. And at one point, you're... The mother of Oscar, she comes to the country. She is leaving the Dominican Republic, running away, in fact. And the narrator asks her, what did she know about immigration? And that's italicized in the book. It's almost like immigration is a land unto itself.
It certainly felt that way to me. I mean, you know, there's this idea that they say... you know, childhood is that country we all immigrate from.
Yes.
But I always felt like immigration, that actual time, space, that chronotope, when you're a young person and you're in a completely new culture, you have to learn the new culture while simultaneously navigating it and trying to make sense of how you got to this place and how much of what is considered the old culture is useful. That's a tremendous experience. And despite, you know, again, even though in the U.S. we claim to be a nation of immigrants, that immigration is a central pillar of who we are, I still think the time space of immigration, especially as experienced by young people, is unexplored. It's an undiscovered country. It exists, like I've been saying, in an enormous silence. And for me, you know, as an artist, I'm really interested in that. I mean, if you could talk, if every young child in the United States, every young person going through an immigrant experience could actually speak truthfully about what they're feeling and what they're going through, I think we would have a very different sense of what this country is and what America means.
And what is the difference for a young person? I mean, you came to this country at the age of 6 from the Dominican Republic. What is the difference for a young person coming to this country and for their parents?
Well, I mean, my joke always is that you really don't live in the United States. I mean, you don't know the United States unless you've been to high school here. I think that high school is like one of the primary disciplining institutions.
The cauldron.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, like American identity. I think that, I'm telling you, man, it's like you want to learn a society up close, you got to see it in the front lines. And that is where the kids are formed, where people are taught, and schools are usually that institution. And, I mean, I'm telling you, man, in the Dominican Republic, we had a lot of screwed up things. It's a kind of a tough country. It's had a lot of, tremendous challenges. But I never encountered kind of that ferocious hierarchy among young people till I came to the United States. That sort of like savage competition wasn't normal where I came from.
Right.
You know, I mean, we didn't have kids who were just tormented to the point where they couldn't come to class anymore. Or kids that you were like chase down the street and beat them up. But, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to paint a sentimental picture of what youth was like in Santo Domingo, but there are different cultures. And I think the United States is a lot of people say, they're like, yo, man, this is a tough place to be a young person.
Yeah, you know, I could really relate. I grew up in Patterson, as a matter of fact.
Oh, man, welcome back, P-Town.
And I was also a nerdy bookworm who was ostracized by other kids. So I really loved your description, because what you're really talking about here is also your character, Oscar Wilde. And I loved your description. I'm going to just read a very, you have it in a footnote, just a few sentences here. And you say, what is clear is that being a reader fanboy, for lack of a better term, helped him, that's Oscar, get through the rough days of his youth. But it also made him stick out in the mean streets of Patterson even more than he already did. Victimized by the other boys, punches and pushes and wedgies and broken glasses and brand new books from Scholastic at a cost of 50 cents each, torn in half before his very eyes. You like books? Now you got two. Ha ha. No one, alas, more oppressive than the oppressed. So it is his fellow immigrants who are sticking it to him.
Oh, yeah, man. I think come on, man. It's always interesting that it's always the other inmates who make life more miserable. You know? I'm just like, damn, you know, wish it was like some of the stuff you see on TV. But no, it's definitely... I mean, Oscar, the one thing about, for me, this book I wanted it to be was a record of what it's like to be smart and nerdy in a community like the one we're talking about, Patterson. Mm-hmm. What that feels like to be smart and nerdy in a community that really looks down on that and sees it some ways as an aberration.
Yeah, and he's also not exactly macho. I mean, he's hugely overweight. He comes in for a lot of flack for not being able to get a girl. And in fact, the other boys say he's not a Dominican. What's that about?
Well, you know, it's like every culture has like cliches about, even amongst ourselves, of who we think we are. We have a series of shorthand you know, and of course in Dominican culture, well, not of course, but in Dominican masculine culture, of course, a shorthand for what's a normal male is that he's a full-out player.
Mm-hmm.
So a kid who's awkward around girls and, you know, who doesn't bear some of the more like accepted sort of stereotypical tribe markings is going to be ostracized. And Oscar, as you point out, he's kind of got a cascade of bad luck. He's smart. He loves books. The books he loves are like genre, science fiction and fantasy. You know, he's very awkward around girls. He's very shy. And yet he wants a girlfriend more than anything in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and then therein lies his own apocalypse that eventually happens to him.
Well, you know, it's weird. It's one of those things. I always look at Oscar and I look at the narrator, Junior, who is quite a different kind of Dominican, quite a different kind of character. You know, Junior's, I think, a lot more, some would say he's the more normal Dominican of the pair. But in some ways, Junior's like a big chicken, man. He spends his like entire time like lying and being kind of traitorous. And, you know, he doesn't like to do things that are really hard. I mean, if there's a challenge, he tends to shy away. And even though Oscar's fate is kind of brutal, one of the things I admired about him as a character is that he was always honest to himself. And that he did something that I could only dream about, which is to, like, lay everything on the line for the possibility of love. Not for love itself, just the possibility of love.
Right.
And I don't have the courage in myself to practice that. So, of course, I have to create a story about someone who can.
Well, that was a question, you know, that occurred to me throughout the book. There was a sense that I had, you know, kind of one often wonders how much is autobiographical in a book, but I had a sense almost of you, maybe because there is this narrator, there is this character of the Watcher. I wasn't sure if that was Junior or not. Who is the Watcher?
Well, the Watcher, of course, refers to, well, not of course, but for some who know, and for those who don't, the Watcher refers to a character straight out of the Marvel Comics Fantastic Four. And this is a character, a super being who stands on the moon and he just records everything that happens on the Earth. He's like the great witness to humankind. And so the Watcher in the book, the book we're talking about in my novel, is Junior's narrative persona.
Yes, and the book is The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. We're talking with the author, Juno Diaz. So I wondered if I felt you as a personality, the author as a personality, come in and out of the book as the Watcher, as in some place, in some way, Junior, and also as Oscar. So I just wonder, could you say something about how you wove your own sense of who you are in and out of those characters?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I got very lucky to find a narrative voice after a long period of experimentation. Junior's voice, his voice as a narrator, you know, it took some work, but once I got it, it was very productive. But I think that one of the things that, for me, that was very key was that, you know, it's to grow up where I grew up and by the sounds of it where you grew up and to love books and to dream about the world was a really lonely space. The part of me that's most in this book was a lot of that childhood loneliness I had by being smart in a place where people thought that wasn't a great idea.
And his sister Lola also, and I was struck by the difference in the voice there. She is told in the first person, and as you said earlier in our interview here, Oscar is not he's in the third person. She's in the first person, and her voice is much more eloquent and poetic. I kind of wondered about that.
Yeah, she's also not as funny. I mean, she's been through a lot of stuff. Doesn't make her quite have a sense of humor about these things, you know? Rightfully so. I mean, she's one of the survivors. One of the reasons I think we get her voice is, you know, when everything goes down and everything is said and done, there's only a couple of people still left who can tell the story. And so she's one person who helps to tell the story of this family and the story of this boy. You know, this amazing,
right,
nerdy boy. And so, you know, I had to find a voice for her that made sense and that kind of communicated both her kind of strength and vulnerabilities. And that's the one I fell upon, you know.
And a powerful voice it is. I think you exactly captured that kind of struggle between mothers and daughters. And I felt a very strong female presence in the book also. There's not just the mother and the daughter. There's also the great aunt, La Inca, who at one point prays to save the life of her adopted daughter and brings in a character, the golden-eyed mongoose. And here's this element of magical realism, again, that comes into the book. Could you say something about who that is? Is that a Dominican character as well, or is this some your own invention?
Well, no, I mean, the mongooses, they were imported, or I should say they were brought to the Dominican Republic from India. The British first brought them to Jamaica, they made their way to Cuba. So the mongoose is a migrant, an immigrant to the Dominican Republic as well. And one of the great trickster figures on the island. Mongoose, as anybody who watches 5 minutes of Meerkat Manor, know that these are very social, very industrious, and very resourceful little tricksters. And so, there's a lot of myths and a lot of stories accumulate around mongooses. And it wasn't necessarily that I was trying to do anything magic realism. It was more that there's just people on the island that believe that there are supernatural powers, the way that there's people who believe in UFOs. And, you know, there wasn't anything fancy about that, any attempt to, like, prettify any of it. It was more that, you know, I couldn't imagine a book about the Dominican diaspora without someone having a superpower, without there being some sort of ancestor spirit, or some sort of like elder or an ancient or an old one. You know, the same way it's hard for you to imagine a book about the Dominican diaspora without a scene set in college.
Do we have a caller? Oh, we don't. Okay. Finally, in the minute we have left, actually, I wanted to come to a point. Bailey, who is the mother of Oscar, says that she's learned that she can never run away. She did run away from, really for her life, from the Dominican Republic. She says the only way out is in. And you write, that's what all these stories are about. Could you say something more about that?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I, I went to grad school at Cornell. I'm a state school boy, and then went up to Cornell. You know, that was the first place I ever saw a library, like a real enormous research library. And in there they had, of course, they had one of the original Dante's Inferno. And that's one of the things I've always loved about Dante's Inferno, is that, like, the only way that we get through hell is not by trying to. And I think that in some ways, really, to me, has always seemed an honest way to approach the things that we're most scared of, the things that we have most trouble with, the things that haunt us. You know, the more we try to deny them or repress them, it's kind of that Freudian, you know, the return of the repressed, the stronger they become in us. And I think sometimes the only way to, you know, put these things from our hearts or still that unease is to really confront them face on, to push deeper in, you know. And that's part of something that I kind of liked, and I wanted to just sort of see if I could make it a theme.
Well, the book is The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. We've been talking with Juno Diaz, and he's coming to the area here tomorrow. He'll be speaking at Franklin Patterson Hall on Hampshire College, on the Hampshire College campus, and that's at 7:30 p.m. I want to thank you so much, Juno Diaz. And is that how to pronounce your name, or is Juno?
No, it's Juno.
Okay.
Exactly that.
It's a
thank you so much.
A wonderful mythic name itself.
No, I'm telling you, man, I got pegged with a good one.
You certainly did.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Take care, you guys. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Next week, we talk with famed British Next week, a special on global warming. We talk with famed British environmentalist Meir Hellman about the book he co-authored with Tina Fawcett and Sudhir Chela Rajan. It's called The Suicidal Planet, How to Prevent Global Climate Catastrophe. Also, we find out how to go on a low-carbon diet. It's a 30-day program to lose 5,000 pounds. We talk with the author, David Gershon.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at www.writersvoice.net. You can catch our podcast there and listen at your leisure. Please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to write@writersvoice.net. I'm Michael Pollitt.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.